My name is Clancy. I'm an alcoholic.
Clancy.
That was a cruel thing she said, but I wrote it for her, so I can't. I hate to think that I'm getting older now and getting too sentimental, but I'm forced to say this. I guess I'm getting too emotional, but I want you to know one thing, Irving. If I had one day to live, I hope that I would hear you give the announcements here. It would seem like forever. I want to thank Dick and his charming wife for inviting me to come down here. And I've been off my feed for this year. I had to cancel out a lot of places because of my health. But I'm all right now, I guess. Mostly all right. Since I've been here last, I turned 90 and 91. And it's very difficult for me because I've always had an eye for pretty young newcomer girls. Now I can't do anything about it, so I just have to go up and say things like, "Hi there. Does your grandma put out?" You know. Not much of an advance that way. But I'm glad to be here, and I've enjoyed this conference. I enjoyed the Bob and his charming wife today more than usual, because he made me think a little bit about things, and it's very good when you start thinking in AA meetings and people are making you think. But I grew up a little, not too far from Bob, up in northern Wisconsin. And I ran away at 15 to the ocean. I wanted to get in the war, and the war was still on, and I think I could get there. I wanted to get in the Marine Corps and fight battles against Japanese cruelty. And I got to San Francisco, and I couldn't get in the Marine Corps, couldn't get in the Navy at 15, couldn't get in the Army, couldn't get in anything. So I got the Merchant Marine, where if you told them you were 16, they believed you. And I was on a ship sailing around the Pacific Ocean, and I had a good time. I was too dumb to be afraid. And as soon as I was 17, I joined the Navy. At the end of the war, I was in the Naval Hospital of Northern California. And got out in February. Came home to Wisconsin and went to college that fall at the University of Wisconsin. And all these years I didn't, what's this for? Are you trying to get room service? What? I'm a speaker, for Christ's sake. I'm not just some guy saying, huh? But anyway, all those years I was floating around the ocean and so on, I never drank. And the reason I didn't drink is because I didn't like it. When I was a boy growing up in a very strict Norwegian Lutheran church, hardly anybody drank. They'd have a beer once in a while, my grandpa would. But I would never drink much, and I tasted beer, I didn't like it. They'd be drink whiskey, and I didn't like it. So I was they used to call me the little minister. Because I wouldn't say, no, thank you. I went to college, and I started drinking there rather heavily, primarily because after classes, there'd be two groups, the veterans and the good kids. The veterans go raise hell, and the good kids would go to the Cardinal Newman Club or the Norwegian Lutheran Club, and just dreadful little snots. I went with the veterans, and they were all drinking a lot. They said, "Aren't you going to drink, for Christ's sake?" I said, "Yes." So I started to drink a little bit, and much to my surprise, it made me feel better. And so I drank a great deal. By the time I was getting out of college, I was drinking a lot. but I'd done very well in school. I gave the commencement address on behalf of the senior class, and I was editor of the yearbook, and I was a member of a championship team, and did a lot of things that I squeezed in between my drinking, and I was still handling it well. And at commencement, there was something wrong. We went through commencement, and I got a blank certificate of graduation. And the reason for that is I had gotten incomplete in my last quarter in English history. A little bag, she gave me an incomplete, which she should have done, because I couldn't get up at 8 o'clock for the class ever for a whole semester. And so I had to go to summer school. I was hired to teach journalism at Duluth, Minnesota, at Denfeld High School. I had to go to summer school, and I had to get a job. I got a job at U.S. Rubber Company, balancing white sidewall tires 8 hours a day. I went to school 3 days a week to get these 3 hours in. And at that time, I was drinking a lot. I'd stop on the way home from work and get drunk and tell everybody about the sad story, how I've done so much for that damn university, and they gave me an incomplete, for Christ's sake. That's wrong. And they got, after a while, they didn't want to hear it anymore, you know. But one night a girl came in who I could tell by looking at her, she wanted to hear that story. And I told her that story at length. And she said, that seems odd that you got a dirty shirt on, you got smear marks on your face, your hands are dirty. I said, well, I'm on my way home from work. Do you want to see what I'm talking about? She said, yes. We jumped in her car, went down to the university. And, of course, it was all locked up, 1 o'clock in the morning. But I knew how to get in. I took a rock and I broke a door. And we got in. It wasn't the first time I'd done it, so I knew how to do it. And we went up to the trophy room and opened the door and turned on the light. A whole trophy case full of pictures of me holding trophies. And she was overcome. She slumped to the floor. And I thought, oh my God, she's had a flat tire. And I tried to pump her up as best I could. And I was not 91 then, I'll tell you. But a policeman's flashlight illuminated this scene. I'll tell you, if you want to have an instant recovery from lust, that's a good one. What the hell are you doing there? Nothing anymore. And they arrested us. They charged me with breaking and entering in the nighttime, which is an automatic 5 years in the Wisconsin State Penitentiary. And I thought, uh-oh. But fortunately, the school got in some clout over the night, and they got me reduced it to drunken, disorderly behavior. I still remember sitting in the courtroom that morning, waiting for the judge to come in, and he was a friend of our family. I knew he'd give me that look that I got so many people. And guy came in with a box, said, who's Emerson? I said, I am. He said, this is for you. I looked inside the box with all my school books, all my notebooks from the university, and a note on top from the dean saying, I covered for you as long as I could, but I can't cover this one. You're expelled. Expelled after I graduated. That's kind of a nice token. Later on, I got a telegram from Duluth saying that my job had been canceled on the grounds of religious or moral turpitude. I thought, well, screw them. So I had to get a job. I got a job working at the U.S. I didn't want to work at the U.S. Rubber Company for the rest of my life. I got a job on the newspaper writing sports. And that's maybe the best job I've ever had, my favorite job. I like sports, I like writing, and I met a girl with black flashy eyes and black hair and just so much different from all the girls I met in the Lutheran church. They all were blondes and blue-eyed and said, huh? But she was exciting. And she won my heart. We were married. I became the father of a premature baby. Only 4 months old. But anyway, I remember that very well, living in this little apartment where we lived and had a bottle of vermouth and a bottle of gin. At last I could have as many drinks as I wanted to drink. And we had a good life. And then she had a baby, which changed everything. I had to stay awake and stay home at night and take care of things, and it was just dreadful. But I kept drinking. I stayed drinking at home now, and she used to cry a lot, and I wanted to slap her, but I didn't, because I knew I'd be an AA someday. By the time I was a senior in college, I'd been to AA already, because I was drinking so much. And somebody said to me, you ought to try AA, and I went to a couple AA meetings. I thought they were dreadful, dreadful. Just those 12 steps were like the 10 commandments. Those are things that nobody ever does, but people talk about them a lot, you know. Oh. But I got a job elsewhere, and I started my career. And my wife, one of the reasons I like Bob's talk, he talked about how after 7 years he came to his realization that he was doing it wrong. And I didn't come to that realization. I just worked from crisis to crisis to crisis to crisis. I wound up finally in Texas. I was working in a big advertising agency because I could write well. And I was really getting along well. I was writing, if you remember the Elsie and Elmer ads for the board company, writing the conversations they had. I should have just written moo, but I didn't. But one day the boss called me in. Said, I want to talk to you, Clancy. He said, you're really doing a good job on those Gordon ads. Thank you very much. He said, I'm going to have to let you go. I said, why? He said, well, last Friday, the chairman of the board of Fritos toured the mission. And he said, you were drunk in your office. And he was very offended by that because he's a very religious man. And let me explain what happened. These salesmen came over, they bought me a lot of martinis, and I'm usually not that way. He gave us an alternative, either lose you or lose his account, which is like $10 million. So he said, we're losing you, unfortunately, so by 5 o'clock tonight, please be cleaned out and be gone home. And he gave me a big severance check. And I started that severance check, and that morning I went to work, I remember that, November 19th, 1974. And I got fired, and, 54. Huh? 54. I didn't holler at you when you talked. Then I went to Notre Dame and was expelled as a senior. He went to Notre Dame, and this is the only year in living history where they had no defeats. I want to commend you on that. But anyway, where was I? Oh, yes, I was going to Notre Dame. Huh? 54. So, yeah, October 19th, 1954. And I'd been to AA off and on, different places, over the past few years. Since I'd graduated, didn't graduate, and I went to AA, and dreary people, dreary. In Dallas, there's something called the Town North Club I went to, where I'd stop in every morning on my way to work and swear, this is the day I'm going to quit drinking for my kids' sake, because I had several kids by that time. And the old swamper would say, you got to just do it. I'd say, I'm going to do it. And I'd leave the go to this big fancy office, and by noon I'm getting thirsty, and by afternoon I couldn't wait for that big stein of beer, cold beer, to cool me off, and then drink till I was drunk, and then come home and raise hell with everybody. But anyway, he fired me, left me a big severance check. I didn't want to go home because my wife was already getting testy after all these years. Not again, but they said the magic word, we've called your wife and told her you're being discharged today. I thought, oh, what a rotten trick that is. She'll be on ready to go when I get walk in that door. And so I didn't go home. I stayed downtown and cashed my check and rented a room in a motel and found some new friends. And we partied for a couple of days. Then I ran out of money, so I had to go home. So I drove home. And on Drexel Drive, just next by the SMU, very fancy neighborhood. And there was nobody there. My children weren't there, the furniture wasn't there, but my clothes were all piled on the porch. And I went up and looked at the piles of the porch, and there was a note on them. Anytime they get notes, they're bad news. We can't take any more, we're leaving. She and the children, three daughters left. And I thought, well, Jesus, I just got out of the Texas Nut House, which was unfair, because I had had a job in El Paso, and I directed the El Paso Civic Theater, and I directed an opera at the University of Texas. And when the opera was over, I followed on evil times. Everybody turned into a crap head around me. And one morning I woke up and I was feeling especially depressed because I really made an effort to stop drinking. I'm going to stop drinking, I said. And I stopped drinking for 2 or 3 weeks. And I woke up and I was just so depressed and so desperate. I thought, if I get a cup of coffee, maybe I can go to work. And I'm out of the kitchen and no coffee. Just a note on the table. I've taken the children to church. I thought, oh, shit! All I want is a cup of coffee! And I got crazy. Out of the garage, and I pulled the car in the garage, and I put a hose on the exhaust pipe into the car, and I committed suicide and died. And a neighbor watching us through his window from his breakfast nook. Oh, there he is. Now, what's he doing? The motor's running, and he didn't come out. Maybe he's sick. And he came over and found me dead in the car. And he wheeled me out, pulled me out, and they breathed in my chest and got the ambulance there, and they rushed me to the hospital and oxygenated me for 2 or 3 days. Then they came to the reluctant conclusion that I had deep-seated emotional problems. Just because I died, for Christ's sake. And so they committed me to the state insane asylum at Big Spring, Texas, for an indefinite period till I got better. Thank God I found a way around that. But I went to the Nut House, and I don't know if you've ever been to the Nut House, I'll tell you, don't go into a small town Nut House, because the big town Nut House, they have professional caterers and things. But small town Nut House has got the local dummies. Hey, boy, get you a room, will you? And the first night I was there, I remember that so clearly. I was just standing in the hall trying to think whether I should go to bed or not. And somebody around me said, But after a while, you get used to the evening scream, and not bad. And I was in that house for some time. And they saw on my schedule that I had directed a grand opera, Mephistopheles, in the original Italian. And they said, we think we can trust him. We'll have him direct a Christmas pageant. So I directed a Christmas pageant a few months after directing a grand opera. And it was much more complex than the grand opera. So now I had to keep three wise men off the Virgin Mary if I thought. That came off fine. We wanted to worship her clients. And after that, I was restless and irritable and discontent one more time. And one of these big attendants came one day and says, "Hey, boy, you seem to be a little restless. Don't get any wrong ideas. Don't ever try to escape from this hospital. This is an escape-proof hospital." I said, "Oh, is it?" That gave me a new goal. And it took very long before I got escaped, found a way through a door, across the patio, through another door, over the fence, and I was gone, top speed, out amongst the chaparral. And it turned out to be really an escape-proof hospital. I didn't know it at the time. But I don't know if you've ever been in West Texas, but they can see you running for 3 days. "Well, there goes that little Yankee subbitch now." They brought me back and gave me 3 months of electric shock treatments for that. And after a while, I didn't remember ever running even. I just... "What's your name, boy?" "I don't know." "Hart Schaffner Marx." But that summer, the state of Texas, in their wisdom, did something that I still think is stupid. But if you committed someone to the hospital, if you would agree to take care of them, they would release them to you in your care. And that picked up the spur. I tell you, my letters home took a new tone to them. "Oh, honey, I'm so lonely for you tonight, and the children. If I could only be in your cuffs," you know, on and on and on. And eventually she came down to Big Spring and got me out. And I went home. And God, I was glad to get a few drinks into me just to feel good again. And then I convinced everybody that I'd learned my lesson. So I got this big job in Dallas. And I now knew that the day I got fired, she probably revoked her permission to take care of me. So I got to get out of this state somehow. So about 2 weeks before that, the guy had called me and said, "Do you know anybody who wants to move a car to Los Angeles? A friend of mine's got a car. He'd pay for your gas and pay for your meals." I said, "No, I don't know anybody who wants to do that." But that morning I knew somebody who did. And I called him up. I said, I got a guy for your car. "Who is it?" "Me." "I thought you were a big shot at Tracy Locke." They're all phonies. I had to quit. And I got in that car, and first day I made it to El Paso, 300 miles away across the desert, which was a pretty good driving stint for the afternoon. And I looked around very much for a place to hide my car, but I knew El Paso pretty well. And I found a place to hide my car and my clothes and all my money. And I went to Juarez, where I have been known as a living legend. And by midnight, I was standing on the bar of the Chinese palace one more time, singing, "Yo soy el maestro de los locos en Chihuahua." And my fans all sang, "Cabrón, cabrón." I think that means welcome in Spanish. And the next day I got as far as, had to get that car moving though. Got as far as Phoenix, which was another 300 miles. And in Phoenix, I didn't know a soul. I had to look for 2 hours to find a place to hide my car. That would be safe. But I found a place. I know it's a safe place. I never found it again. Car's still there as far as I know. And I was on the street looking for that damn car at nightfall, drunk. Guy came out of the street in a suit. I said, "Buddy, help me find my car." He said, "Don't bother me." "I said, for Christ's sake, come on. Help me find my car." He said, "Don't bother me." I grabbed his lapels. I said, "Just help me find my car. I got to find it." He said, "You should have done that, boy." Took out his badge and said, "You're under arrest." Took me to the Phoenix jail. And he said a thing that haunted me ever since. He said, "I'm going to cool you off, boy. But you don't cool off in a jail. It's 135 degrees, I'll tell you that." But I woke up in the middle of the night, I was so sick. Oh God, I was sick. And I went over to what I was sure was the toilet, I threw up in it. In case any of you are new tonight and you get arrested, try to always throw up on tile. Not because it's neatness, but after you're done throwing up, you can put your cheek on it. It's so cool and nice. And I fell asleep. And the owner, the guy, some trustee came back. Apparently I'd thrown up on his bed. And he said, "You drunken son of a bitch," he started kicking at me. I know he didn't mean to do it, but he kicked out my upper front teeth. I said, "Now what?" But I had blood, vomit all over me. They let us out at 5 in the morning, which they do at 6 in the morning. And you hit the street and the sun's coming up, another hot day. And I thought, I got to get out of here. And so what I remembered was, they told me in AA, if you ever get in a real jam, go to an AA club. And I remember this AA club on Erridge Avenue. And I watched some people walking around me because I smelled bad and looked bad. But I noticed this old lady sitting across the room from me, sizing me up. She finally came over and said, "Are you sick, young man?" I said, "Oh, I'm so sick. Help me, can you?" She said, "How could I do to help?" I said, "Well, I want to get into a 12-step house, but I have to have $20. I don't have $20. She said, "Oh, here's $20. I took the $20 and ran downtown and bought a bus ticket to Los Angeles. I didn't know why I wanted to get there so bad. I got there and I didn't know a soul. The bus depot that was in the middle of Skid Row. And I remember I gave a guy a start in Dallas many years before that. That he turned out to be a big success. I thought he probably won't talk to me. But I called him up at his TV station. He said, "Oh, Clancy," he said, "I've many, many times thought about you, how wonderful you were to help me. Would you, come on over and see me. I had a terrible car accident." And he said, "Well, you come right over. I'll see about that." He told me how to get the bus out to Hollywood. Now in this big TV station he had a sumptuous office. People, who in the hell is that? And I went in there and he had tears in his eyes. He says, "Oh, Clancy, I hate to see you look like that. What's happened to you?" I just get the shit kicked out of me, really, that's all that's happened. He said, and he whipped out his wallet, took out several $100 bills, and said, "Here, get cleaned up, and give me a call later." I went down the stairs and rented a room in a motel and found some new friends. We partied for a couple days. Then I ran out of money. I had to call him back. I said, "Tim, I'm out of money and my car hasn't got fixed yet and I got no check coming in. Could you help me?" "Oh, yes," he said. "But I'll tell you, Clancy, when you were here, I felt so bad. I called Dallas immediately and I found out you used to be a nice guy. We all agreed to that. But you turned into a drunk." He said, "I don't want to give you any money to drink with." "Jesus, please help me, Tim, for old time's sake." He said, "Okay, you come to the alley back of the station tonight. Don't come in the front door. And I'll come out of the fire escape at 9 o'clock. If you're there, I'll see what I can do." So I was out there in the rain, pouring down. He said, "Clancy, you make me sick." He threw a $5 bill that tousled down into the mud puddle. And I crawled out and got it. Thought, "Ha ha, I fooled that old son of a bitch." And the next night I was in an all-night theater on Skid Row. And I don't know if you're familiar with all-night theaters on Skid Row, but they don't run all night really. But they're designed for people, street people, to get out of the rain for whatever. And the fare, the ticket jumped from 85 cents to 15 cents at midnight or something. And I was in an all-night theater. And they don't last all night. They run till 5 in the morning. Then some guy comes and says, All right, you bums, everybody out. And the guy behind him with a hose, hosing down the floor. So you know you got to get moving. Now it's out of that theater into the rain, still raining. I thought, Jesus, what am I going to do? The guy said, you want to sell a pint of blood? I said, do I ever? Up here, we went about five blocks up 4th Street to where the Red Cross Blood Bank was at that time. And we went in and sat down, and there's several of us. They took a drop of blood out of all our ears, and we waited for them. Finally, the guy came up and said, who's Emmislund? I said, I'm Emmislund. He said, well, you don't have enough iron in your blood to sell a pint of blood here. Sorry. You'll have to leave. I said, oh, come on, for Christ's sake, I'm so sick. You got to help me, please, please. He said, I can't help you, pal. Move it out. He said, look, down here about four blocks, there's something called the Midnight Mission. It's a skid row place. Go down there. Maybe they'll give you some breakfast. And I went down there in the rain, and I walked in. I see a guy with a suit on. I grabbed his lapel. I need some food. He says, we're done serving. We just served breakfast. We're all done. I said, come on, for Christ's sake. Just a cup of coffee or a roll or something. He said, we can't help you. We're out. I said, come on! And I shouldn't have shook him. Two guys stepped over, and he shook one hand and detached me, and jaywalked me to the doorway and threw me out to the sidewalk at Los Angeles Street in the rain and said, don't come back, you phony son of a bitch. I added him to my list of people I want to get sooner or later. And that morning I thought, I got to get off the show. I'm going to die. I'm dying. And so I said, where's an AA club around here? He said, there's no AA club downtown anymore. There's one at Wilshire and Fairfax. I said, where the hell is that? He said, you go up Wilshire, cut over Union one block to Fairfax, then go west, keep walking until you come to Fairfax, or until you come to Wilshire and Fairfax. And said, on that corner, so I kept going through the rain, just, it was almost like, it turned to be 17.5 miles. I just, everything else had gone to hell, why not? And I got there, and I almost didn't get into the club. There's a guy in the doorway who was just going in, and he said, welcome home, son. I thought, oh, shit. And I went in the club, and I had no idea. That was October 31st, 1974, 58. I'll tell you what it was. It was 7 3/8. And threw me out, and I had to do something. So I got in this club, terrible club, just full of signs and slogans and live and let live and first things first and all that crap that never works. And I had no idea that would be the beginning. And a couple weeks ago, I celebrated 60 years of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to tell you the secret of how to stay sober 60 years. Don't die. After that, it's nothing to it. And I stayed sober, and the one thing in AA that I disagree with is in the first step. You can discuss it tomorrow morning, is that they ask you to admit you're an alcoholic. You must have come to resolve that you're an alcoholic in an innermost self. And I don't know hardly anybody. I've been working with people for years. I don't remember anybody who believed they're an alcoholic when they came to AA. They came here because they drank a little too much. And they suffered a lot of bad breaks and misunderstandings, but they weren't alcoholics. But if you go to meetings every night, after a while you identify. You start to hear it. And over a period of time, I went to a meeting every night. I had nothing else to do. I was living in an abandoned car in the AA Club parking lot. And one of the reasons I knew I was getting better, because I One night I met a guy at the club who had no place to go. It was raining again. I let him have the back seat of my car and I slept in the front seat. Never mind, just kindness. Son of a bitch never said thank you at all. But I, a little bit, I got a job. In fact, after I was about 5 years sober, I had a sponsor who was just a terrible person. I thought, he didn't share with me anything. He told me, "How much did that? Shake hands with people. They're a bunch of assholes. Why should I? Because I told you to. That's why." Nice to see you. Go thank the speaker. Screw him. On and on. But he saved my life. He saved my life. When he died, I got another sponsor named Chuck Chamberlain, one of the mentioned, and he never told me anything for 20 years. I was his baby. He never gave me any direction. He said, "Just watch what I'm doing." And I watched what he was doing. And it was, by that time, I was able to watch a little bit. But if he didn't buy a sponsor when I was new, I'd have died. I needed someone to say, "Shut up! Nobody cares what you think, you asshole!" You don't read that on sponsorship bulletins much. But he saved my life. And I eventually, by the time I was 5 years sober, I got a job flying to New York to get some papers signed. And then by that time I'd been to a convention in Long Beach, international convention, and I'd seen Bill Wilson. And I thought, I got to New York and I got all these papers signed one day. And the next day I had a free day. I said, "What will I do today?" I think I'll go over and see Bill Wilson. And I went over to the World Service office, and at that time on 44th Street. And said, "I want to see Bill Wilson." The girl said, "Well, he sees people in increments of 1 hour and he's booked up for 2 weeks. I can't get you in. If you come back in 3 weeks, I'll get you in right away." "Well, I won't be around here in 3 weeks." So I drifted off into the archives and looking at old pictures of Bill and Dr. Bob and some letters they'd written to their wives and so on. And here comes Bill Wilson. He said, "Where's the young man who wanted to see me?" I said, "That's me, sir." He said, "Well, my 11 o'clock didn't show up. Come on in." And I went to his office. We sat and talked for an hour. And I was listening in those days. And you know what he said? I don't remember. Some of the "hey, crap, I know that." But little by little, I got a job. Got a job in an advertising agency as assistant production manager. And I lost that job because I went to meetings instead of going to work. And got some more jobs. I got a job in a big marketing position in a manufacturer of medical equipment. And I did very well there. And my wife and my children were in Dallas somewhere, White Rock Lake, wherever that was. And we talked from time to time. I sent them cards and I sent them little gifts on Christmas. Little animals with little poems on them. The only one I didn't send was a little dog that up closely I could see was just been sewed together just about a half inch off. One eye was a poo. And I identified with him. And I kept him at the head of my bed for years. And anyway, so I said to my wife, she said, "They're moving my office to Kansas City. What shall I do?" I said, "Bring the children to Dallas. I got from Dallas to Los Angeles. I got a place for you." I rented a house on the west side. And they came in on the train, and I went out to Riverside, which is the next stop. And I sat behind them and listened to them talk about how they were going to see Daddy. That was kind of cute. And they weren't very thrilled about it. But anyway, I got there, and a couple of weeks later, I got a job. I got an offer from somebody. Said, do you anybody wants a... The director of the Midnight Mission just died. Perhaps you'd like to notify someone who wants to be the new director. I said, I don't know if anybody wants to be the director of that goddamn mission. And that night I was talking to my wife in bed. I said, you know, that mission did nothing for me except abuse me. But I always have kind of an amend. My sponsors always ask me to make amends. Maybe if you go down there and I'll maybe straight. I talked to him a little while, talked to the chairman of the board, and he said, well, it turns out that we're in difficult shape. The paperwork is all screwed up. I said, well, let me come in here for 2 or 3 weeks and straighten it out. That's kind of a personal amend for me. And so I went down there, and after the end of 2 or 3 weeks, I was really getting to like it because I was used to shuffling papers at an off desk, you know. But here there's excitement and cops and murders and deaths and suicides and paperwork. So I told him I'd do another 3 weeks. Now it's been 44 years I've been there. I'll have it straightened out pretty soon. But to this day, I feel a little odd when people say, what do you do for a living? I run a Skid Row mission. Oh, do you? Yes, I'm proud. But now we're, over the years, we've done very well. Got people in there, and we've, I brought the first instructions. Take a van, take these alcoholics to the AA meeting. And now I'm in another group, big group on the west side called the Pacific Group, which I'll tell you how that started. The biggest meeting in Los Angeles was the Brentwood Group. And they selected their secretaries by their steering committee. And I had a stooge on that steering committee. I said, mention my name. I saw him the next day. I said, did I get elected? He said, no, died for lack of a second. So I knew there's not going to get ever elected there. But somebody came up to me a few weeks later and said, the Ohio Street Tuesday night meeting has died. Do you know anybody who wants to start a meeting? I said, yes, I do. And I wrote a format based on things I'd learned from my sponsor and other people. And we just celebrated 50, 60, 70, I don't know how long. 55 years. I have, you want to give my talk, you people? Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Barry.
Barry who?
Barry Money. Anyway. But there isn't a week gone by that I can recall where hasn't somebody gotten that podium to get a cake that says, I owe it all to the Midnight Mission. It makes me feel my life has not been wasted. But running a Skid Row mission is probably the best thing that ever happened to me. It gave me a lot of elbow room, and I ran it any way I wanted to run it. Nobody knew a thing about it. I just put in policies that they would have not ever done. And if you're an alcoholic, you're going to a meeting. And even started the meeting finally there. But over the years, I have become somewhat successful. And one thing about my sponsor always grabbed me. He said, make amends, make amends. And one nefarious night in Dallas, I borrowed a pickup truck from where I was working and wrecked it. I was always sorry for that. He said, go back there and make amends for that truck. I said, Christ, I don't have enough money for it to eat on. He said, well, don't eat. Just save up the money for a bus fare. And I went down there, got in to see the guy. I said, I'm here as if to make amends to you because I just screwed up that truck and I'm going to make it right to you. If I send you $1 a week, I'm going to send it to you until it's paid for. He said, what's this about? I said, well, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, why? I said, because I'm an alcoholic, I guess. He said, I don't think you're an alcoholic. Why did I do those things? I thought you were an asshole, and I think you're an asshole now. Get out of my office. I was certainly glad I'd go to the meals to get that bus fare paid. And the next thing he told me, he says, "Now I see you're saving money to go home and visit your folks after all these years. Go back to the University of Wisconsin and make amends." So, okay. I went back to the university after the guy who'd been the dean, who expelled me, was now the chief chancellor of the university. So I went to his office and I said, "I want to see the chancellor." She said, "What's your name?" I said, "Clancy Emmerslin." I heard her go and say, "Clancy Emmerslin is here to see you." I heard him say, "Tell him I'm not here." Well, I made my effort to make an amend. I went back and told my sponsor that later, and he said, "Well, you got to try it again. Got to keep doing it until you make them." I said, "Oh, Jesus." But I'd go back and see my folks once a year or so. And finally, went in one day, and she said, "Clancy Emmerslin is here again." He said, "Oh, my God, let him in. I'll get rid of him." So he let me in. The chancellor said, "What do you want, Clancy? You almost cost me my job. I covered for you so well. And you almost cost me my job. Thank God they read it off, so I'm a chancellor here." I said, "I want you to know I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm trying to make amends. I don't know what I can do to make it right, but if you can think of a way to make it right, I will." So I made that amend finally. And the next spring, I was sitting in my office. I got a call saying, the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin is on the phone for you. I said, "Really? What does he want?" And it was his secretary, actually. She said, "The chancellor says that he knows that you and he don't get along very well, but we have a problem maybe you could help us with. We were supposed to have an alumni luncheon next week, and the man that's in charge of it is dead. He died 3 months ago. No plans, no nothing. Could you possibly help us find a place?" I said, "I'll call you back." I called him back in about an hour, and I said, how about where the movie stars go at night at the hotel? What's it? Huh? I've been very sick. What was it?
Coconut Grove.
Coconut Grove, that's right. I said, "How'd you like the Coconut Grove where the movie star go every night? And you can go there on the Sunday afternoon and just wallow in it." She said, "Really?" I said, "Yes, really." I didn't want to tell her. I sponsored the manager. That's how it was easy to do it. And I said, "On one condition, that I get invited." She said, "But you're not an alumnus, really, are you?" I said, "No, but I should have been." And I got invited. I remember that Sunday, having a cup of coffee with him at the Coconut Grove, look at the pictures of all the stars. He said, "Clancy, what's this I hear about you devoting your life to helping others?" I said, "Well, it isn't really the point of doing it, but I'm trying to do that." He said, that's not like you. You're selfish. You're introverted." I said, "Well," he said, "I want to see that place in all its pristine purity. Let's go over there right now. Don't call them and tell them we're coming. Let's just go over there." So we jumped in his car and went over there. And of course, it was Sunday. We just scrubbed the place down, and the sidewalks were scrubbed. Old drunks on the street saying, "Hi, Mr. Clancy. Hi, Mr. Clancy." He looked at him funny. We were inside my office. You remember that old office where they had some awards on the road, on the street, on the walls? And he said, "This is amazing. I've never known anyone so directed as you. And now you're helping people. There hasn't been a miracle like this since God changed water into wine. This is amazing." Well, that's where it goes. So he went back and went home. And that was the end of that story. And I made my amend there. Then that next winter, I got a call from, "This is the chancellor's secretary. And he's retiring this year. from the university. I said, oh, that's good. She said, but here's the odd thing. He has named you Distinguished Alumnus of the Year. Will you come back and talk at commencement? And I said, you bet your ass I will. I didn't really say that. I said, yes, thank you. And I took all my kids back with me. They visited their grandma and grandpa. They were divorced when I was a kid, but they were both there. They were crying over the one child they had turned bad. And I went back, and that gave me a great feeling, a surge of do more for people. And I've been at the mission ever since. And we have a lot of people who come in there who are dying, and my job is to turn them around if I can. And sometimes we can, and sometimes we can't. They die regularly on our property. But I don't know what to do about it. You hear a lot in the papers about the homeless problem. I want to tell you something. I've been working on that problem for 44 years, and I don't know that there ever will be an answer. There's no answer to the homeless problem, because so many people want to be homeless. I don't want some goddamn housing. Just leave me alone. And across the street from our house, our mission is a whole block of tents of people who build a tent so they can not have to be responsible to anybody. And as long as there are people like that in the world, there will always be homeless. Chicago, they devoted a whole big apartment complex, the Mother Cabrini Conference, to homeless people. And in 6 months, every window was broken. Every hall was full of urine. And so they shut it down. Doesn't help. It helps some people, but not very many. But that's my job. And my children have turned out well. Only one of my children has gone bad. She's a judge. But she was home a few years ago for Christmas. She says, remember, Daddy, when we were little girls, you take us and make us go to our room and sit and think about what we've done wrong? I said, yes, I remember that. She said, when you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to put you in a little room and you can sit and think what you've done wrong. I've never gone near Albuquerque since. But I have an irony in my family. I have four daughters. Three of them are alcoholics, celebrating 30 years this year. And the fourth one wasn't easy. But the fourth one is not an alcoholic. She just finished her term as teaching for years at the University of New Mexico. And she used to be a nun when she was a young girl. Then she became a nurse and hurt her back lifting somebody and became a teacher. And she's a Al-Anon of the first water. And my three alcoholic daughters talked her into coming home and taking care of Dad when my wife died about 4 years ago. So I come home at night, and it's the same old shit. Take your pills! But she's saving my life. She's got my car keys, and she won't give them to me. I'm going to kill her! I don't know where she's got them hidden. If I knew where she had them hidden, she wouldn't be able to last till dawn, I'll tell you. But now my children are all grown up. One of them is, three of them are in AA, active in AA, and very active. One of them, Susie, I think, is the best AA in our family. She's a better AA than I am. She speaks a lot, is the secretary of the meeting, sponsors people, and doesn't talk about how wonderful she is. Unlike certain people. But she is I'm very proud of my family. A couple weeks ago, I was on a cruise celebrating my 60th birthday. And I took my whole family with me. And they had a wonderful time until I got my American Express bill. $12,000 is a lot of money. It is. But easy come, easy go. I said, shit, you know. And One thing I want to tell you, what I remember in my life is most of my life, when I was fighting to stay sober, my head would get so busy, run back and forth and on, I felt unsafe, suicidal almost. And tonight when I got up, I said, my name is Clancy and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm glad to be here tonight safe and sane and sober. If you're new tonight, and you're sitting in this cloud, I want to tell you something. You're in the safest place you'll ever be in your life. You are safe here. There's a bunch of people here conspiring to make you feel better. And sane, I'm down to just direct thoughts, usually how to pay that American Express bill was one. But I have very easy thought. I don't have that all over. So I want you to know one thing. Whatever you might do, you're here because you're safe and sane and sober. And if you're not, you will be. And recently, I've come to believe rather strongly in God, which a lot of people think is silly. But I want to approach God as though I'm young again and before I got spoiled by my own meanness. And so every night when I go to sleep, I say, now I lay me down to sleep. I pray thee, Lord, my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray thee, Lord, my soul to take. And I go right to sleep. And it sounds kind of corny, I know, but I've done everything in the world you can think of. I've spoken around the world. I've done all sorts of things. I've been in movies, done everything. But the magic of my life is I have come to believe in a power greater than myself, in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous that has enabled me to live at peace with my children, with my world for 92, almost 92 years. And I'm, I think about that. Several people have said, you remember my sponsor? Yeah, he's dead. Everyone I know is dead. Except those two, and they're not looking well. Three, I meant. Four. Let me tell you about tomorrow morning's speaker. Because I'm old and now feeble, 91. And when I go to the airports, now I ride in the wheelchair. And in Houston, which is a big airport, a guy who came out with a wheelchair, and I jumped in a wheelchair, he took me to the top of the ramp and said, this is as far as we go. I said, he said, there's a cart there. I said, I don't want to be in a cart. I want to go there. And he didn't want to hear it. And so Miss, your morning speaker tomorrow, Miss Sharon, I want Grace, her last name, Miss Sharon said, I'll push you. And she pushed me all the way through the airport. And I gave her $5. And I'll tell you worse, the bitch took it. But all I can say is, I'll say it one more time. If I get nothing else, I'm so pleased to be safe and sane and sober. Thank you.